A psychologist from Harvard Medical School meets a social work professor from the University of Southern California's School of Social Work. A doctoral thesis on trauma and terror culminates in a children's book titled Becoming a Superhero. A trip to Israel together changes their professional and personal trajectories. Today, on the American Jewish Medical Association podcast, The Jewish Voice of Health, we talk trauma-informed care with our guests, Dr. Mary Bar-Halpern and Susie Hess. I am your host, Bob Belfer. Welcome, Mary and Susie, to the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. So both of you, I'm sure, in the business world have heard of the brief elevator pitch. You're on an elevator with a colleague and you want to get a job, so you have to pitch what you're doing. So let's get to know a little bit about each of you as the podcast elevator is in motion. Mary, why don't you start?
Sure. You know, it's an interesting question, Bob, because if you would ask me before October 7th, I would have a completely different answer. So I will go with everything that after my life has changed. So I am a mother. I'm an immigrant. I moved from Israel 16 years ago to the U.S. for my doctorate in psychology and dedicated my life to understand trauma, to treat trauma victims. And I'm also working with prevention of trauma through an organization called Parents for Peace. And really was not aware at all of anti-Semitism. So fast forward, right now, one of the biggest things I'm doing is finding anti-Semitism and the way anti-Semitism and trauma go together.
We'll talk about more about Boston and Harvard as we progress. Susie, the elevator pitch, who is Susie Hess?
Like Mary, before October 7th was a whole different Susie Hess. And after October 7th, really starting on October 8th, my focus began on supporting students and faculty who were experiencing anti-Semitism at USC. I'm also the co-founder of Trauma Informed LA, which again, before October 7th and then starting October 8th, Trauma Informed LA is always focused on fostering resilient communities, but those communities did not include Jews. And not because we were excluding, I'm a Jew, but I never thought about it. I never thought about it until October 8th. Now, since I met Mary in Israel in March of 2023, we have a podcast that has been focusing on dismantling the polarization of anti-Semitism on college campuses. So that's my elevator spiel.
Susie, go ahead. Why don't you plug the podcast? Give us the name of the podcast.
So the podcast is called Our Stories Matter, Season 5, We Will Dance Again. And the cool thing is that when Mary and I were first met in Israel in March, we thought we're going to do the podcast. We never met, but we're like, let's do a podcast when we're in Israel. And then she and I both became, you know, we've experienced firsthand and secondhand trauma being in Israel. So we thought there's no way we can like do a podcast. I went mute. So we decided to collect names of people that we met, Christians, Arabs, and Jews in Israel. So we've been interviewing them as well as other people back in the States that we've been meeting as well.
Great. And Susie and Mira, I've listened to multiple episodes. And again, it is a must listen to. Some very interesting people, like you said, from all different walks of life, both Jews and non-Jews. All right. So we have experts, bi-coastal experts, and you have boots on the ground. Mary at Harvard on the East Coast. Susan at USC on the West Coast. Mary, let's start with you. Harvard, the target of congressional probes. Alumni revolting over the administration's equivocal response to the attack and the subsequent anti-Israel activism on its campus. Harvard's former president, Claudine Gay, was forced out last January after testifying before Congress that calling for the genocide of Jews may violate the university's rules against bullying and harassment depending on the context. What a phrase. And many of us look forward to Harvard alum Shabbos Kestenbaum's upcoming lawsuit against the university for condoning anti-Semitism. Mary, what's it like in Boston? What's it like at Harvard?
Oh, man. You know, I chose to live in Massachusetts and Boston because of the academia. And, boy, was I wrong. So let me start by saying I'm currently not on the campus. I'm supervising people. I affiliate with McLean and with Brigham, so I'm not there, but I'm treating the students and the faculty from there. And it's been hard. There is a lot of gaslighting. There is a lot of criticizing. There is this concept that I've been trying to talk about in multiple places, traumatic invalidation. And I think what the Jewish community after October 7th has been feeling is traumatic invalidation, which is the idea that was coined by Marsha Linehan and Melanie Harnath and was tested about a lot of other marginalized groups, but not on Jewish people. And there are different criteria, and we meet each one of them. And it's really the concept when someone, a group, community, people that you care about or authority figures are telling you that your experience and your emotions, they're not accurate. And it's coming as blaming, it's criticizing, unequal treatment, and there's a lot of different ways of doing it. And that's what the students and the faculty have been experiencing. So the message is for these communities, you don't matter. Your feelings don't matter. In fact, you're wrong and you're the cause of the problem. And what I'm seeing on my end is the mental toll of that. People are feeling distressed. They have no community to trust. They lost friendships. Some of them don't want to go to school anymore. I have a student who just refuses to go on campus. It's been bad, and there's not a lot of response. And the community, the mental health community, unfortunately, is not rising up enough to support staff and to support the students.
Mary, have you seen that type of trauma before October 7th in any group of people? I mean, it's sort of a niche type of trauma. Obviously it's been studied, reported, but is there any other example, any precedent for this?
Of course. It's been studied on a lot of other marginalized groups, and we see it a lot with trauma survivors in general, when the environment is not validating their experience. And that by itself can lead to post-traumatic stress syndrome all the way, right? So it's been tested with LGBTQ, and it's been tested with under racism, for example. Melanie Harnath did a ton of research on that. Not on Jewish people. And that's exactly what I'm studying right now, is to prove from all the case studies that we have, all those examples, that this is actually happening to us right now. We're seeing it everywhere. And the interesting piece is when you start talking about it with different individuals that experience that, their reaction is, oh, I'm not crazy. There is a name for that. It's real. And that by itself is a very validating experience and very regulating experience.
And Mary, I think you're being a little bit humble. I think I've read a lot of the work you're doing with these Jewish students and even faculty is pro bono work.
Yeah. So basically after, I don't know if it was a smart idea or not, but on October 7th, out of stress, I guess, I posted my personal phone number on a Facebook group for Israelis. And I just said, if anybody needs help, give me a call. And got a lot of phone calls and then realized I'm too much for one person. And I was able to gather a group of amazing clinicians that are doing all of this for free, providing one-on-one support and groups and webinars and whatever is needed.
Amazing, amazing work. Susie, let's go to the West Coast, University of Southern California. Now I read, Susie, you actually have been a big DEI proponent. Let me talk about a study I just read about this morning. Looked at anti-Semitism in American healthcare. Less than 2% of healthcare institutions' anti-bias training included content on anti-Semitism. Susie, why is DEI and anti-bias training still in existence? Convince me and our listeners why we should expand education in our anti-bias training versus eliminating this training altogether. It doesn't include the biggest growing form of hatred. Anti-Semitism.
Thank you so much for asking. Yes, it has been a huge journey. So I'll give a little bit of background. I've been part of ADEI, Anti-Racism, Diversity, Equity, Inclusion. Okay. I was the one who was the first faculty at USC Suzanne Dwork Peck School of Social Work to include anti-racism within the curriculum of my classes. Okay. No pushback was happening. In terms of like the reasons, it was more of like logistics, but not the reasons, like the reasons made sense. Then October 7th happened. So on October 8th, I'm like, oh my God, we have not been including anti-Semitism, and it's not part of any discussions. So, I was told that I was being too strong about anti-Semitism. So, Mary knows all this because at that time, Mary and I were developing more of like, wait, what the dissonance of what's happening on college campuses versus what we saw in Israel. So I was told I was too strong. So as a Jewish woman, you can't tell a Jewish woman she's too strong. And then just because there's that focus of oppressed and oppressor, and there is no nuance. Jews are not considered white by white supremacists. And we're considered too white for the BIPOC communities and DEI communities. So we sort of are like lost, and there's not that nuance within DEI. A colleague and I, Dr. Yehuda Price, he's a former student, and he was born to a Muslim mother, Black, formerly incarcerated for 16 and a half years. He and I just wrote co-authored an article about this, about what can we replace DEI with, because it doesn't seem like we're being welcomed, because we've been advocating like to include us in what already exists. But because there's so much pushback, colleagues have gone silent, you know, as I'm advocating, as well as, you know, saying that I'm too strong, I'm too loud. And again, as a Jew, you can't tell us we're too loud when we're experiencing the number one experience of hate crimes per capita in this country. So I think there's not room for us to be in DEI, according to people who are running DEI, unfortunately, because I would love to be part of it.
And where are we today as far as including anti-Semitism in DEI curriculum at USC? Any movement, any progress?
Okay, so let me start with strength-based. So the strength-based focus is that I started a Jewish faculty group. So we call ourselves the Jewish Life Committee. I also started a Jewish student affinity group with another colleague. Okay, we advocated, and it was approved, but the reasons that we had to advocate, that's a whole other ballgame, to have Dr. Robert Williams, who is the executive director of USC's Shoah Foundation, speak to faculty, speak to students. It was powerful. It was beautiful. I mean, it's given me hope. I mean, yes, it's frustrating that I have to advocate just for someone to come in and speak. There was a lot of pushback, is that if we're going to speak about this, we should speak about that. And I'm like, I think there's many spaces to speak about other groups. Why can't we be a standalone? So that was my strength versus like, why are we even having to advocate?
Right. Let's stick with you, Susie. By the way, my wife is a social worker. I believe the field of social work, and I'm sure you do, is filled with practitioners with empathy, compassion, advocates whose goals are to create social change for marginalized groups, minority populations, except for Jews. Why the blind spot?
Yes. One, that's amazing that your wife's a social worker. So obviously you get us. I think the blind spot really goes back. And by the way, I drank the Kool-Aid before October 7th. You know, so I wasn't really including myself in these discussions. I advocated always for folks that were not me. So I think the disconnect is really within the philosophy of DEI, that it's focused on your skin color. It's a social racial construct. And yes, I understand what happened in this country, of course. And that we are nuanced, because the majority of American Jews are Ashkenazi, which means that we have white skin. I do not consider myself white. I say I am a Jew with white skin. And because I have white skin, I am connected to colonizers, to oppressors. So why do we need to be advocated for? So I think that's the disconnect with DEI, to be honest.
You know, can I jump for a second, Bobby?
Sure, Mary.
It's really interesting because, so I recently joined a fabulous nonprofit. It's called Parents for Peace. And I'm the director of trauma services and training. And Parents for Peace is fighting radicalization and extremism around the U.S. and Canada. And what I've learned from them is that concept of DEI, which, by the way, we don't have it in Israel. This was all new to me when I moved here, and someone during grad school told me, you're white. I'm like, oh, I'm Middle Eastern. It's not exactly that. That concept of DEI that Susie described, that you're oppressor, black and white, like very concrete, rigid way of thinking, is actually making people more vulnerable to then extremism and to be radicalized. And especially when you're starting in K-12, because that's where we trace it to, K-12. And when you're an adolescent and you're already in a very vulnerable state and your brain is still developing, when you're not being trained, taught to think in a more flexible way, and you're coming from those type of construct, if you're under the wrong person, you're more vulnerable to then be radicalized. And I think what we're seeing on college campus today is the result of that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's talk about both of your niches, trauma-informed care. Mary, how do you define that?
Oh, trauma-informed care. The best way that I will think of defining it is seeing everybody, understanding that everyone has a story, and making sure that everybody, including Jewish people, feels safe in their environment. And how to make it happen, that's the being informed, from the person in the organization that greets you to the door all the way to the top of the organization. That's what makes someone or organization informed, being able to recognize that people have a story and they might have trauma.
Okay, and before October 7th, Mary, give us some of the types of patients and the types of trauma that you were dealing with in your practice.
So my training, my dissertation was about trauma of war and terrorism. That's what led to my book, Becoming a Superhero, after I realized that I was growing up during the Second Intifada. And only when I moved here, I realized, this was not normal. I have some trauma symptoms. And I realized that my story was very unique compared to my colleagues. So I dedicated my career to understand different types of trauma, anywhere from sexual abuse, emotional abuse, neglect. And I work primarily with children and adolescents. And then because they're part of a system, started to do more family therapy and parent coaching as part of it. My specialty is self-harm and suicidality in general. And the easy stuff.
In teenagers, specific teenagers? Wow. Okay. Susie, trauma-informed care. What type of trauma, again, before October 7th, what kind of patients, clients did you deal with?
So before October 7th, I still do it. Now it becomes both and. So before October 7th, I'm a co-advisor to students who were formerly incarcerated at USC, and they call themselves the Unchained Scholars, and they have actually been incredibly supportive and incredible allies. I was not formerly incarcerated, but I saw a gap at USC where students who were formerly incarcerated were not receiving the support or resources that they needed. Okay, then October 8th, then I was like, oh my gosh, there's Jewish students who are feeling scared and isolated and they need support. So that's when a colleague and I, we both started a Jewish student affinity group so that we could support Jewish students. And, you know, trauma-informed care is really thinking about not what is wrong with you, but understanding what happened to you. And so that question has been very different from October 6th to October 8th for me in terms of who is experiencing trauma and what that looks like and the nuance of it.
Let's travel halfway around the globe. Let me ask both of you a rhetorical question. How do you deal with the trauma of the deadliest day Jews have experienced since the Holocaust? We're talking about October 7th, 2023. Over 1,200 Israelis were killed, some 250 taken captive in Hamas's attack on Israel. The massive attack by terrorists immediately was followed by additional traumas, displacement of tens of thousands of Israelis from their homes in the conflict zones, the subsequent war, which has left hundreds more soldiers dead, thousands wounded, emotional scarring on a national level. These experiences are beyond anything we have ever seen. Some children were taken hostage, witness their parents' murder or kidnapping. And Mary, these events often happened in places that their parents said were the safest in the world. Parents could not save their children, or they had to choose. We have new forms of trauma that we don't understand. So Mary, again, I'm going to turn that rhetorical question into a real life question. How do our Israeli colleagues deal with this type of trauma? Easy question, right, Mary?
I feel like I need to take a breath before answering your question, just from the going back to October 7th. And we need to understand that the trauma is still happening. right? It is continuous traumatic response because there's still war, as you mentioned, and people are still displaced. And there's no protocol, right? So I've been, since the 7th, I've been in touch with my colleagues in Israel and trying to provide support and training to the hospitals there. And in our podcast, actually, we interview a few of our colleagues from Israel, Dr. Nesrin Lubat from Gea Mental Hospital, and then from Schneider Hospital. We also interviewed that they accepted that some of the children hostages. And they were talking about how there's no protocol. It, as we go, we create a protocol. And I think, by the way, that's the resilience of Israelis, that we adapt. And there is something about we have to survive, and we have to figure out a way to do it that is the most efficient way, not just to survive. You know, there's a difference between resiliency, I bounce back, right? Most of us can bounce back, but how do I grow from it and how do I give it meaning as well? And I think a lot of our colleagues in Israel are trying to do exactly that, is to give meaning to the events and not just survive the events. How to do it? You know, Israel is one of the leading places in trauma treatment. There are a lot of evidence-based intervention. The problem right now is that there's not enough people to do it. Right? We don't have enough mental health professionals. There's not enough funds from the government. There are a lot of colleagues here that want to volunteer, but we can't because of licensure issues. So actually, when we went to Israel with a delegation, one of the things that came out of it is how can the academia here and people from here maybe help the academia over there and relieve them from maybe teaching a class or supervising so they can attend to mental health and help people over there. I know there are a lot of initiatives to try to bring more evidence-based therapy to Israel in a way that is fast, easy delivered, and in a way that we can get out of the brick and mortar as much as possible. But unfortunately, there's no straight answer to that because we're still trying to figure it out.
Sure. Susie, in the social work literature, again, Miri said, there's no manual, there's no protocol. Any precedent that you could look back on, maybe just the Holocaust. But again, most of those people hid the trauma. They didn't speak openly about it. They suffered from PTSD, which I guess it wasn't even described back then, for decades. What is the social work aspect of the trauma that we've seen and continue to see, as Miri said, post-October 7th?
Yeah, I mean, I think really focusing on the mind-body connection. So on the podcast, we interviewed Dr. Ilana Kartin from Healing Space, and their whole focus, it's incredible what they've been doing, is that on October 8th, they started, and the whole focus was on the mind-body connection. So one, I think we have so much research on how that is so critical now that we didn't have during like the Holocaust, for example. The other thing is that storytelling, which is part of what you're doing on your podcast, what we're doing on the podcast, is that stories matter. And Miri and I were hoping that by having people talk who are Arab, who are Christian, who are Jewish, that that can create more humanity so that we're not seeing the rage and the anger just because you are who you are. And social work, in terms of social justice, I think that is a huge piece of advocating for civic engagement. And the encampments, which was a whole other thing where people are talking about, oh, they were peaceful. Where blocking people is not peaceful. I believe in protests. I've protested. I believe in all of that. And they have to be safe. And today, actually, today's episode dropped a student from UCLA, a 19-year-old student from UCLA, Ellie Sivas, who is a major advocate at UCLA. Super brave and courageous. I never would have done that at 19. You know, doing it now and coming out is a big deal. So I think advocating is huge in social work. I think we're just not, people are challenged to understand the importance of safe protests, of nonviolent, compassionate protests. And that would be the social justice piece that I think is missing right now with the encampments.
Absolutely. Miri?
Yeah, that's true. Another thing that's in Israel, and I wish we had more of here, is similar to Healing Space Respond, which is beautiful. There are a few other resilience farm and resilience spaces in Israel, which is amazing, right? There is Danny's Farm. So remember, we went over there. So Danny's Farm is one of them. And there are, the idea is, how do I bring therapy to the community? Which I think goes to what you're saying, Susie, also, how do I break stigma and shame around it? And I think if it's on a community level, people are also more inclined maybe to get the help. Schools, for example, how can you make school more trauma-informed and deliver intervention? And because Israel is a startup nation, a lot of people are working exactly on that. How do I create interventions that can be disseminated everywhere in Israel and hopefully around the world afterwards?
Mary, you talk about a stigma here in the United States, mental health. But in Israel, where pretty much everyone has been affected, is there still that stigma, or are there sort of people are looking for help and accepting of that?
You know, it's an interesting question because, as I mentioned before, Israelis have this idea of we're going to survive. And not only are we going to survive, right? Like, you're going to see us in the street and the restaurants are going to be open. Remember, we were in Israel and Susie was shocked that all the bars are open and the restaurants are open. And I was trying to explain that's part of being an Israeli day experience is you will not let them win and break our spirit. But that by itself has a lot of gravity and can cause some invalidation, because if I'm actually struggling, but the environment is not showing me that it's okay to struggle, that can lead to some shame and that can lead to some stress and symptoms. So I think it really depends on the community you're in. Even within Israel, it's a very diverse community, right? It's not, everybody are not the same, just like not, you know, a lot of people think everyone in Israel are white. We're actually not. There is a lot of changes and a lot of diversity between religious and non-religious and Ashkenaz versus Moroccan, and where you live in Israel has an effect as well. So to your question, I think there is still some stigma, but not as much.
I see. In physical health, when we have a plan of therapy, it's a week of antibiotics, it's 4 weeks of physical therapy. Let me ask you, Susie, when you're consulting someone, trauma-informed care, someone who lived through, whether it's a child, an adult, and you could give the scenario, how long is it going to take for them to recover? Will they recover? Will they ever recover?
Such a great question. I mean, I think there's a lot of factors. One is the protective factors of, do they have safe relationships? Do they have access to resources? Also, I think it's sort of like grief, you know, talking about grief meaning death, is that after 1 year, people stop asking the person, like, how are you? How's your heart? How are you? The same thing with trauma. And I hope we keep these conversations going because, I mean, just imagining, we had one of our guests on the podcast, Natalie, who escaped from Nova. And, you know, she talks about dancing again, physically dancing again, but her mind is still there. And so really having those conversations and recognizing it never goes away. I think it takes a different form and we learn how to coexist with it. And I think that's where the mind-body connection comes in, of recognizing who is safe for my nervous system and who is not.
I see. Mary, trauma-informed care. Again, I am not an expert. You guys are the experts. Let me ask you a question, though. Is trauma-informed care impacted by how or what, let's say, the government or other bodies respond to those that committed the trauma? So an example, if a child has been raped, and the person who did the rape suspect has been convicted, jailed, or a gunman shoots at someone and now the gunman is jailed. Does the impact that government or the judicial system have on the perpetrators change the way trauma-informed care is delivered?
I mean, I think so. I think it changes for the person, the victim, right? So if I see that the government or the people in authority are taking actions and punishing the perpetrator, then it's validating my experience that it's not my fault. I did not do anything wrong. But if what's happening right now around the world, and specifically in the U.S. with all the events, think about the assassination of the CEO of the insurance company. People are cheering for the murder. This is a whole new reality. Just like on October 7th, people were cheering for Hamas. The message as the victims or the victims' family is that, oh, it's us. We're at fault. We deserve that, which is obviously going to make the symptoms much worse. So I think absolutely. I think the way that we respond as a community, authorities, government to the action is important, and not blaming the victim.
Right. Susie, I know both you and Mary visited down south, the kibbutzes, Nova Festival site, as did myself with my wife a few weeks ago. And we talked to people who lived on the kibbutzim. And let me give you just two polar responses we got. One side was very upset with the Israeli Defense Force, they wanted Gaza to be razed, just eliminated. Another person said, we've been at peace with these people. We run on the same trails. We garden in the same area. Again, the land adjacent to the kibbutzes and Gaza. So again, getting two polar opposites as far as what we should do, that has to affect their own trauma and the trauma of their families, and more importantly, the Israeli people. Susan, your thoughts?
Yes. So Miri had not arrived yet. So I was at the kibbutzim, knowing no one. Like, we all, 30 people, just like flew to the Middle East together, never meeting each other, you know, from the various schools. So when we went to one, I will always remember what he said. So there was someone who lived at the kibbutzim, and he wants peace. His entire community was wiped out. And he kept saying, I still want peace. And that gave me chills because, you know, fight, freeze, or flee. I still am going through all three of them, probably hourly. And I couldn't believe how, and obviously in the kibbutzim, there was so much connection to the people in Gaza. They were all like living together. They were coexisting. So that I'll never forget, that he wants peace. I couldn't believe that. And I understand when you said that there was someone, you know, who's like, wipe Gaza. I get it, because when you're in fight, freeze, or flee, I mean, that's where you're gonna go. And with time, my new thing is I am not sending emails until I wait at least 48 hours. So how can we regulate our nervous systems? But it makes sense to have both, I think.
Right. Miri, I'm sure you visited the sites too. How important is it for therapists, professionals, to visit the scenes of the terror, the kibbutzes, the Nova site, in their practice, to be advocates? How important is it to sort of, I mentioned before, boots on the ground, to be and look at that, the sites in southern Israel?
It depends if you're an Israeli or not. As an Israeli, you live the trauma. You don't have to physically be there to feel it and to understand it. You can literally place yourself in their shoes. I remember that even though I'm like thousands of miles away, for the first few weeks after the 7th, every time I put my kids to bed and like did my, you know, good night and they're sleeping, I saw them covered with blood. I wasn't even there. It's indirect exposure. I think what happened on October 7th and the fact that it was, you know, Hamas had those videos everywhere. You couldn't avoid seeing that we're all traumatized. Different for someone who hasn't been in Israel and is not Israeli. I think that there is something to say about understanding how deep this experience is, not just from the direct exposure of the trauma. This triggers every single thing we learned and taught and our intergenerational trauma. I mean, I'm a third generation Holocaust survivor. Those are things that I heard about from my grandparents. Right. So I think there's something about bringing communities to really understand it, or actually show people, because people don't believe the horrors. I mean, people, because nobody can imagine something so horrific. So the point that we need to show people the movie that was created with Hamas videos, by the way, just so they can believe us and validate our experience. So for those people who don't really understand how deeply this trauma is and the ripple effect it has on all Israelis, on all Jewish communities around the world, they should absolutely go to Israel and see it for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, I saw all the videos. When we were in Israel, we walked through Kibbutz Be'eri, saw the burnt out buildings one after another with pictures of those who either died in the house or were taken hostage. Susie, what are your thoughts about being on site there, how that helps you professionally? And do you advocate your colleagues here in the States, hey, it's let things quiet down a little bit more in Israel and get over there. You need to see it firsthand.
Yes, absolutely. I encourage everyone to go visit. I mean, when I was there, I really, and I've been talking about this, I lost sort of the ability to express what I was witnessing. And so it makes sense also when the hostages are coming out and it's hard to even put words to what you're experiencing. I strongly encourage people to go visit and to see. And for me, another colleague who is an incredible ally, he had said to me, I think your strength and your advocacy of, like, quote unquote, coming out now is because of all the people you met when you were in Israel. So when people try to shut me down, I think about the kibbutzim. I think about Nova. I think about the grandparents, the parents, the children who've lost siblings or who are being held captive. I think of them, and then I keep speaking. So I think it's given me a lot of strength to keep going, and I hope my colleagues will visit.
Great. I want to close by something, listening actually to your season 5, episode 1, We Will Dance Again podcast. A theme went running through that podcast, and that theme can be described in 3 words. Susie, hope versus fear. Can you have both? Do you need one? Do you need the other? Tell us how you look at those 3 words.
Oh, that's such a good question. I have both. And Miri and I, I go like hour by hour where I'm fighting, I'm advocating, I'm in it. The podcast is so fulfilling. It gives me so much hope. And then there's a lot. Then I go into fear and despair when I get, you know, hate messages, when I have colleagues who are questioning the podcast or questioning that I'm even experiencing anti-Semitism. So I go through despair. And then I meet someone else like you, Bob, and I'm like, okay, now there's hope. Like, after this podcast, I'll have hope again. So it's sort of hour by hour.
All right. Well, Susie, the feeling's mutual. Miri, hope versus fear. Take us home.
All emotion matters at the end of the day. Emotions tells us something about a situation. There's signals to tell us what's happening to us. You need to have both. I think for me, the fear is often moving me to do, to protect, not to avoid, actually. I tried my best to recognize, okay, I'm feeling fear right now. Who is my community? Who are the people I can trust? And what can I do? I'm an action person. I need to do. And seeing people gathering and helping, that also gives me the hope. So I'm a big believer that all emotions are important, and we're not doing as much as human beings to listen to our emotions, and we should absolutely listen. But I would say that this is not for everybody. When I give talks about anti-Semitism to teenagers, for example, I always tell them, check with yourself. Where are you in your awareness? Where are you with your emotions? If you don't feel safe because of fear, fear tells us something. And if it's actually not safe, find the safety. Safety is first.
Excellent, excellent. Well, on behalf of the American Jewish Medical Association podcast, I want to thank both you, Susie, and Miri, for your expertise. And probably more importantly, for transitioning your career after October 7th to do something that matters personally with your professional expertise. So thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.